Oh, the opening of Knoxville, summer of 1915, written by Samuel Barber. And the way we begin this very special edition of The Song Is You with our guest. He's a landscape architect, garden designer, garden maker, as he likes to say. Author now.
Yes.
Jack DeLashmet, welcome.
It's good to be here, Bonnie. This is the hardest thing in the world. I'm so excited that you asked me to do this. But I have never in my life had such a difficult time picking my 10 favorite songs.
Now, wait a minute. But you picked 22 favorite gardens in your Hampton's Gardens book.
Well,
that wasn't difficult?
It was difficult. That was difficult. But I stayed to a very strict vetting process in my book. And that my strict vetting process for picking my favorite, most meaningful songs fell apart so many times.
That's why he brought a disc with 52 different songs.
In case we choose something along the way.
I said, Jack, top 10. 52 he comes in with. Oh, my God. But this absolutely, this piece by Samuel Barber would have to be number in your top five.
Oh, it's, I would say, in terms of a song that has, that touches me and transports me to a place, and in terms of just the brilliance of the marrying of James Agee's words about an evening growing up as a child in Knoxville, and then having Eleanor Stieber commission it, the soprano Eleanor Stieber, who was singing, and have for her to have commissioned it with Samuel Barber. And the fact that both Samuel Barber and James Agee were not known to be big to re-edit their work a lot. A lot of this was the excerpts were chosen by Samuel Barber. It was written about 10 years after James Agee published A Death in the Family, and this is a little part of that. Mm. It takes me back to Mississippi, being on the porch, late afternoon, people lying on quilts, all of the things, and
And musically, he captures the words, but the music, he captures that, what, that innocence, in a sense, and that breezy, easy feel of a summer evening, right?
And also, I think he captures the, you know, stertorous, I love the word stertorous, he catches the, in 1915, automobiles would be loud, and then there would be the quiet auto, and then there would be still horseback riding, and then the sounds of crickets, and then there's a little. There are times in the entire piece where it's not just peaceful. There is a little dissonance and discord that I think is you know, talking about all of his James Agee talking about his family, and his father was very sick at that point and died the year 1916.
Yeah, and he dedicated this in memory of his dad.
Yes.
Yeah. But towards the end, even how it ends, it's not all of that easy, right?
No, it's not. And I think it also, this it plays into maybe a couple of themes in my songs about being a little lost boy or something. The last line makes me crazy. It's, after a little, I am taken in and put to bed. Sleep, soft, smiling, draws me unto her. And those receive me who quietly treat me as one familiar and well-beloved in that home, but will not, oh, will not, not now, not ever, but will not ever tell me who I am. And I love that. I love that whole sense of knowing that you're with your family, but that you're also something else, that you're, you know, that you're your own, you know, your own bird in a way.
Did you feel that way, Jack?
I did. Yes,
really?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. Felt very secure in my familial surroundings, growing up on my around my grandparents' home and spending time on the porch and just knowing that you are, but also knowing that you really are something completely of your own making, or that you are your own thing, and that nobody will really kind of tell you who the hell you are.
So you got to be the one to find it out for yourself. You know, it's often said, and again, we reintroduce Jack DeLashmet, who is a celebrated landscape architect, garden designer, garden maker, full-time resident of Long Island's East End, has published this beautiful book called Hampton's Gardens. But I found this great quote, gardens are a form of autobiography, someone once said. And of course, you have to say that is true of music as well. And so here we're doing double duty with you, Jack. Are you feel? Let's pull up the therapist couch and just let you lay out and tell us all about your life, right? Through gardens, through music. Are you going to be able to handle this?
I don't know. I might be weeping in a moment. Just a little puddle over here.
Really? But so tell us a little of the autobiography. You're in, we're just outside of Clinton, Mississippi, I think, right?
Yes, I grew up in Clinton, Mississippi, right outside of Jackson. Grew up originally on homes that were built all around my grandparents' home. Their property was called Wickstead. Grew up with my cousins. My grandfather had built homes for each of his children when they got married. And my father, very smartly, I guess by the time we were 9 or 10, he had decided that it was best that he move away from Wickstead. But it was really our family home. And grew up in the gardens of my grandparents, who were both Garden Club of America members.
That's amazing. Both your grandparents.
Yes. My grandfather was one of the original Men's Garden Club of America members. Oh. And so, yeah, I grew up around people talking about everything from the lay of the land ad nauseum to peacocks strutting on the front lawn to waiting for the 6:15 train to come by from, you know, on its way to Vicksburg from Jackson. I mean, very much this, you know, this first song
reminds you of that. In a sense, you say in the introduction of your book that they were thoughtful gardeners.
Yes.
They had no haste about anything. Yes. And it's sort of Knoxville summer of 1915 follows that
feel.
There is. Feel,
people are not in a hurry, talking of nothing much in particular, quietly talking.
So how did you shift gears into, you know, being this high-powered landscape architect?
I'm not sure I've shifted gears that much.
Really?
I think my songs will tell. Yeah, I think the songs describe somewhere between, I don't know, some little boy who wants to play in gardens to somebody who wants to be performing on a Las Vegas stage somewhere between.
Now here's a perfect autobiographical song. We got Sarah Vaughan doing the song Alfie.
Yes.
And tell us the tale here.
Well, I love the song the first time I heard it, and I have Alfie being sung by everybody in the world. It was covered by everyone. And I guess Alfie came out when I was about, that was 1966, so I was around 9 or 10. And I loved it so much. I loved the song. I didn't see the movie.
I've never seen the movie
either. I've never really seen the movie.
There were two. There was an update on it, too.
There was,
right?
And I'm not sure it was as well-received as the original. But I loved it, and it touched something in me. And so I named my little puppy Alfie, and I had my dog for 2 weeks. I'd gotten Alfie at Christmas. And this distant cousin or great aunt named Miss Nellie McGee showed up to visit us and ran right over Alfie in her big DeSoto. And then as I'm watching in horror and people are screaming for her to move her car, she backs up and runs over him again. So Alfie is a bittersweet.
Oh, yeah, what's it all about?
What's it all
so
about?
Perfect,
Alfie,
right?
Yeah, it's kind of sad, but it's also autobiographical in a sense.
Here's
and
Sarah
I think
Vaughan.
Sarah Vaughan does it best. This is unbelievable.
As sure as I
This song will never be the same again for me after hearing your story about your little puppy. Miss Nellie McGee?
Miss Nellie McGee.
You made that up.
No, I did not. She was a teacher in Clinton, Mississippi, and she was single. She never married, and she was Miss Nellie McGee.
She must have
called
felt
Miss Nellie McGee.
She must have felt terrible.
She
over
did, and I think I just.
Did you get a new puppy at least?
I didn't get a new puppy. Or if I did, I didn't care. I didn't care anymore.
But wow, this song, Alfie, and Jack DeLashmet here on The Song Is You, and with Sarah Vaughan. And you brought along a photograph because you had dinner with Sarah Vaughan?
I did, in 1984 at the, 1985 at the Spoleto Festival. A good friend of mine had gotten me to do a lot of pro bono work, and I said I would do it if I could meet and have dinner with Sarah Vaughan. Well, she couldn't really. Her name was Susan Kennedy. I've been looking for her for years. I said, you know, I'll only do this if I can meet and have dinner with Sarah Vaughan. Well, the idea that I would get to have dinner with Sarah Vaughan was running by the wayside, but I was supposed to meet her. And I got to meet her and tell her how much she had made a difference in my life. And she grabbed me by the hand of the picture that we're looking at. She just grabbed me by the hand, and she said, no, this is a fan. And we went, and we had fried chicken together.
Where was this?
This was in Charleston. There was a great little place that had the best. I knew I had done enough research to know that she loved fried chicken. And we had an evening together that was one of and I walked around for, you know, 8 months on air.
Right. How old were you at this point?
Well, it was 25 years ago, so I'm 25 pounds heavier, so it's been a pound a year since.
It's all the fried chicken, that great Southern food. But so, Sarah Vaughan, what did you say to her? Why? And share with our listeners what difference she made in your life.
Well, she was smoking. I mean, I watched her before I met her. She was smoking in one puff an entire cigarette. After she had performed. And so you don't really think of her with her lung capacity. But she had this huge lung capacity. And after she finished her cigarette in one puff, I said to her, you know, Miss Vaughan, I just wanted to let you know, no one needs to tell you that you're a great songstress or that you're a great talent. But I just want you to know that you've changed my life. You've helped me fall in love when I shouldn't have and when I should have. And you've helped me cry and get over things. You know, you've helped me really live life, and you've made such a huge difference in my quality of life. Mm. And that, and she said, you're a fan. So I said, well, I was trying really hard to get to have dinner with you, and I know the best place for fried chicken in Charleston, and I would really like that. And she said, she introduced me to her band. She said, tell these guys, tell the band what you just told me about me. And so I repeated to them, and she said, now, all right, you just wait a few minutes, and we'll go have dinner. So I love my little picture.
This is beautiful.
She's grabbing me on the way.
Come with me, young man.
Yeah, and in fact, several of the folks who I picked for my 10 favorite songs are people that I've had some kind of relationship with.
Like this next one, Phyllis McGuire.
Yes, Phyllis McGuire was known mostly for the McGuire sisters, who were the number one girl group ever before, maybe even now still.
Before Destiny's Child?
Well, it was something like that.
Really?
So, you know, huge. They were the first Coca-Cola spokespeople. You know, they were the first big, made tons of money and had tons of hits. And then in 1966, they broke up, and Phyllis McGuire had one solo album called Phyllis McGuire Sings, and she has an incredible voice, still has an incredible voice, and I've had the great opportunity to spend some time with her in Las Vegas. She is the quintessential hostess of Las Vegas and still as elegant as you would probably suspect, but also a very lovely spiritual aspect to Phyllis McGuire that I think if you know about the headlines surrounding Phyllis's life, you probably might not think that, but she's a really fantastic.
And she's another kind of smoky voice.
Smoky, schmoozy. And when I coded all of my songs, this next song, because it's one of the sexiest. It's very, very sexy. And I think it's Phyllis McGuire at her best.
Let's get to it.
Springtime that makes the lonely winter. matter seem long, you are the breathless hush of evening that trembles on the brink of a lovely song. You are the angel glow that lights a star. The dearest things I know are what you are. Someday my happy arms will hold you, and someday I'll know that moment divine when all the things you are mine. You are the angel glow that lights the star. The dearest things I know are what you are. So
all the things you are. And that's Phyllis McGuire, chosen by Jack DeLashmet here on The Song Is You. I love your story, and I love that you feel it does have kind of that sexy quality.
Very
to
sexy,
it.
Sexy.
You're
really
just saying
schmoozy.
It makes you feel want to do certain things.
Yeah,
you know?
Martinis, really, you know, slowly rip someone's clothes off.
Exactly. I love, too, this quote. In gardens, beauty is a byproduct, somebody once said. The main business is sex and death.
I think it's true. It is. That's what's happening all around. It's, you know, if you don't have the sex, you don't, you know, you're going to have.
You don't have the beauty,
you got
right?
The beauty, and you got to have death to have the rebirth. So, you know,
so tell us how you were born as a lifelong passionate gardener. How did that happen? You talk about that in your book. You know, you went into this study in your grandparents' house, and you found four books in
yes,
particular.
I had four books from the turn of the last century through the 30s. The Art of Garden Making, Beautiful Gardens in America from 1915, and a couple of others, along with every Vanity Fair that was and House and Garden from, I think, 1930-something, and was always walking out with these great grand proclamations about how I was going to become a Renaissance man, or I was going to become this or that, or, you know, and came out one time and said, I want to be the head of a great salon in Paris. And my grandmother, who had always been very supportive of me, grabbed me by the hands and took me out and said, you know, you can do anything in the world, but working in a beauty parlor is probably not. You should aim a little higher. Of course, I was crestfallen. Aww. But anyway, that's not what I was talking about, grandmother.
No.
Anyway.
But did you end up kind of following that muse in a way? I mean, do you, in a sense, feel your gardens are grand salons in their own right?
Well, I don't know. I try very hard to make each garden I'm working on reflect the genius loci that exist in that place anyway, that I'm really only there to kind of move that along. I'm not there to really impose my, and of course you do, and every artist has an ego, but you try to keep that in check in the landscape. I think particularly now,
changed, right? The whole approach to
yes.
gardening and designing.
Yes, even if I'm doing real formal gardens, I would tend to now use a lot more native plants and think that we owe that to the world. to be doing that.
And you chose to do a book on Hampton's Gardens,
right.
One that hasn't really been done before, which is kind of hard to believe because the Hamptons have been featured, you know, quite often, I would think, in a variety of ways.
Yes. Well, there is not like, and I wanted my book to reflect those books that I found in my grandparents' study. So there at Rizzoli had put out a book called 350 Years of Hampton's Gardening, and it was a smaller book. And this was much more case studies of what I feel are the most important gardens that are happening right now, or the most, for one reason or another, made it through the process of of what I feel to be cutting edge or important or a different or a great the best example of a particular type of garden.
And how you have all different types of gardens in
yes,
this book.
Yes, we have historic, modern, you know, stripped
the
down.
The estate garden.
Estate gardens, you know.
The tiniest garden is how large?
Quarter of an acre.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in you also point out, too, that the Hamptons is considered sort of the epicenter nowadays of gardening?
I think so.
Really?
I think if you take
that?
A look at our soil, our light, the fact that a great amount. Now, my California friends would argue with me on this, but.
And if you're listening, you'll probably argue.
If you're listening, you may argue with me. And you'll have a point, too, that I believe California and the eastern end of Long Island have, in terms of concentration of gardening talent, in addition to our soil and our light and our mild climate, has really – and the amount of money that is available for people – and the interest that our gardeners
That's one of the three M's that you
but
point
the
out,
money,
right?
Money, manpower, and manure. Really yes. So.
I would think out here there's an excess of all three.
There. Yes.
Said lovingly, of course.
Yes,
right,
of course.
Right.
Absolutely.
And you've called the east end of Long Island home for how long now, full time?
This is my 12th year full-time and was back and forth since the 80s, but was starting doing, you know, so I've celebrated my 11th season as a full-time resident.
Congratulations.
Yes, love it.
Would you have thought back in the day that you would have ended up here?
Well, I fell in love with it when I worked on Wall Street for a brief period and started coming to the Hamptons and fell in love with it and started falling in love with the gardens. 20 years ago or so.
But music has always been a big part.
Absolutely.
Of your life, yeah?
Very big part. I start out every day with I call it happy talk, and it's all upbeat or reflective things that get me ready to go out into the open air of
the Hamptons.
Is
Sammy Davis Jr. one of them?
Sammy Davis Jr. is always a part of my morning. There
really?
Is always some Sammy Davis Jr. in my happy talk moments. And I'm sure now I have like 3 days worth of upbeat songs that discuss my, you know, like get out there and let's do it. And I think Sammy Davis Jr. Is particularly when he was doing all the Fantastics and he was in Vegas and he was at his height. He was one of the most incredible performers and also was lucky enough to see him as well.
And this is one of those happy talk songs,
this
right?
This is a happy talk song. I start my day with this, and it's great. It's Sammy Davis Jr.'s.
I got a lot of living to do.
I got a lot of living to do. From Bye Bye Birdie, I think it was.
There are girls just ripe for some kissing, and I mean to kiss me a few. Oh, those girls don't know what they're missing. I've got a lot of living to do. And there's wine already for tasting. And there's Cadillacs all shiny and new. Gotta move, 'cause time is a-wasting. There's such a lot of living. There's music to play, places to go, and people to see. Everything for you and me. Life's a ball, if only you know it. And it's all waiting for you. You're alive, so come on and show it. There's such a lot of living. We'll be right back.
there's such a lot of living to do. Why, there's music to play, places to go, and people to see. Everything for you and me. Life's a ball if only you know it. And it's all just waiting for you. You're alive, so come on and show it. There's such a lot of living, such a lot of living, such a lot of living to do.
I can imagine you, Jack DeLashmet, standing out in one of your gardens and just singing this song. Oh, happy day. Especially when it's completed, right?
I could see myself belting the song out before I go out into the garden.
Okay.
I don't think I want to share that with anyone. That's a private moment.
That's a private moment. How do you all know? And I ask artists this all the time, when it's done. How do you know when a garden is complete?
It's never done.
It's never done, right?
It's never done. It's the difference between architecture and landscape architecture. It's just never done. Sometimes I guess a modern garden could be called done because it's supposed to be static, but even then things mm-hmm. grow.
Yeah.
I just can't, you know, I don't ever consider a garden done. And in fact, I would say that when I was speaking to groups, one of the power of time in the landscape is one of those remarkable things where I would not even tend to plan an entire garden from start to finish. I mean, I would really start from the top and work down on the structure and the trees and shrubs. And I quite often tell clients I don't want to get into that, to the next layer, until we see how these things sit for a little while.
I think that's your southern roots. You got to just let it just sit, right?
I think
you don't have that haste.
Yeah. Well, I think it could be. You might bug people, that bug the hell out of people, but anyway, that's
right.
The way it is. And there is that simple, there's a simple side to me, too, that thinks that we should, that we should take it a little easy when we're...
Well, why don't we do that musically, too, now? How about if we just...
Sure.
Kick back, take it easy, because you chose this beautiful ballad by Katie Lang.
Yes, it's written by Jane Siberry.
Oh, I didn't know Jane Siberry wrote this.
Yes, I love this. It reminds me of North Carolina, reminds me of relationships and dear friends. There's something about this that just talks about us walking in nature. I love the song. It's The Valley with Katie Lang.
And all that
Now that's incredibly beautiful.
Oh, that song does me in.
Valley.
Does me in. Makes me just, sends me someplace. It really does. Just a beautiful song.
When you're out in the garden, do you spend a lot of time, this high power landscape architect. Are you out in the garden a lot? Are you on your knees? Are you doing your hands? Are you in it?
Not as much as Jeffrey, my partner, would like. I mean, our garden, during the season, I'm rarely out. Now is the time where I typically spend Mother's Day for some reason. I'll be in the garden. I feel very close to my mom and grandmother.
Oh, that's
and,
sweet.
And then,
And we're taping this in the fall. The time of taping is the fall. Yes. So this is a time for you to be out.
Yeah. So now we start because we're not quite as crazy installing other gardens for other people. So this is the time when I'm actually cutting back things and really kind of reconnecting to being a gardener.
It's always funny to hear Jack DeLashman talk about his own garden, though, with this book of Hampton's Gardens and all that you've worked on.
Well, it's native grasses. I think most people would think, can't they mow their lawn at least?
And, of course, you call the east end of Long Island home, and you love it here. Yeah. And have you designed many gardens here on the east end?
Yes, I would say 90% of my work is here.
And yet, how did you pick the ones that went into the book, Hampton's Gardens?
I started by looking at the ones I knew. I had a lot of help with people. I had to stick to some very strict parameters about what makes of all of our historic gardens or those that are based on colonial things or whatever, which one is right now kind of the most interesting? What are the most spectacular, if it's a personal vision of someone, like a fantasy garden? What is the most modern? What are the best modern gardens? What does that mean? And what is, you know? So I had to stick very, very close to to how I was vetting out the gardens.
And they were okay, the people that you chose to feature the gardens of, because the name, you name names. I mean,
there were only a couple of people that did not, that asked to remain anonymous, which we did. Although we did mention in certain cases their designer. And everybody in the book was absolutely fantastic.
And the photography is incredible.
Well, Mary Ellen Bartley and Doug Young did the most unbelievable work with me. And I really was able to cut them loose. You know, I kind of told them why I had picked the garden and let them go kind of discover it themselves.
And this is a big coffee table book. And how many pages now in this?
240.
240, something like right. That. And I think of off the top, Larry Carlson's Labyrinth.
Yes.
He has a labyrinth.
A mowed labyrinth.
Mowed labyrinth and grass, yeah, right, on his lawn in Bridgehampton. And then there's the Violet Farm.
Violet Farm, which was, the Griselles moved houses, moved the old Mulford estate for, in large part, to recreate the sense of colonial gardens. I mean, it was the kind of earth, like house moving for the sake of gardens. So
and the photograph, one of them is purely violet.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, Mary Ellen. Yeah. Yeah, beautiful.
Bravo. And you're on a book tour as we speak, yes?
Yes, I am. I've been all over. I will be on the West Coast coming up and back through Dallas. And then in the winter, I'll be in Connecticut. Westchester, and then I speak to the Horticultural Society of New York on January 31st, and then I'll get away to Costa Rica for a little while.
Good for you, yeah.
Work on my garden there.
You have a garden there?
Well, don't think anybody would call it a garden except me. But
how does one define garden? Just give me a word to define garden.
A garden is a domestic... whenever you have you're making a decision about how your hand will relate to the world... and into your little piece of property that you happen to call your own for a little bit of time, it becomes a garden.
And does it contain pieces of dreams?
Yes, it does. I believe that's a very good segue there, Bonnie.
Thanks,
I do. I think there is a sense of, on my gardens as well, people, I think sometimes there's a story, I think, inherent in every garden. I think there's a dream light in some of the songs when I was pulling together for us today. There are senses of dreams. I guess if we're segueing into pieces of dreams, I love Michel Legrand and I love Marilyn and Alan Bergman, some of our greatest songwriters who've been on this show.
They have, yes.
And I had to have something about them. So Sarah Vaughan, once again, kind of comes through. And this is her from a recording in 1966 with Michelle Legrand with the Bergmans present. So I love this. And they apparently had most fun recording this. And all were reveling in each other's ability to have so many frames of reference and to do things in one take, even though everything was kind of not set up.
Set
and really
up.
Beautiful.
Let's revel.
Let's revel.
Miss Sarah Vaughan, you do a nice impression of Miss Sarah Vaughan.
I'm telling you, you know, I've listened. She was very impressed when I met her in the 80s. I told her I did a mean impersonation, but she got a little bit out of me.
Okay.
And I do a mean impersonation of Miss Peggy Lee as well. Miss Peggy Lee is in every playlist that I have
and
across the board.
And why?
I remember Peggy Lee and watching her on the Johnny Carson show, the Tonight Show, and she was always like uber glamorous and never moved her face at all. And she would only you'd see her shoes that were like ballet slippers that were dyed to match her chiffon dress, right? And they'd play little cat and mouse the way she'd kind of, you know, you'd see a little hint of her shoe every now and then. She'd kind of toe tap her. She was a toe tapper.
She was toe tapper.
She was
oh,
a toe
yeah.
tapper. And
you idolized
I
her.
I loved her. I loved Peggy Lee. And I loved, even when her voice was failing and as she was older, and I saw
they
her.
They used to have the oxygen tanks.
They had the oxygen tanks.
Bless
and
your heart.
I loved her even then. And you'll have to turn up the volume on this next song because
we'll
this is
up.
In 1992. And sometimes I'll have it in a mix for dinner or something or for cocktails or something, and you can't really hear it. And in that way, it just touches my heart. It really does. I love this song. I love Gershwin, but I love the fact that this is Peggy Lee's last recording.
But still, it's wonderful.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful.
wonderful, marvelous. You should care for me.
Bless her heart, Miss Peggy Lee.
She was eking it out there, man. She really did. I mean, I just love
her. She was 80?
She was 81.
81? Aw.
Yeah, saw her. She had glittered sleeves on her walker that matched her dress. And, you know, I loved her. And I love the fact that that's just so... It's Peggy Lee at 81. You know, I mean, you could listen to Peggy Lee do Folks Who Live on the Hill or Fever or any of her great things, and she's unbelievable. But there's something about that touches my heart.
Touches your heart.
It's a little guilty. I do kind of sometimes her notes. Get a little smile.
Extra blue in the notes. Yeah.
But she's on every – Peggy Lee's on every playlist. There's something for Peggy Lee.
Okay. You know? And haven't you been known to sort of channel Miss Peggy Lee and Halloween at times or whatever. And
I did perform at a friend's 40th birthday party as Miss Peggy Lee with a little backup band in Ireland 2 years ago.
Just 2 years ago.
And it was circa 1972, Peggy Lee. It was very good. I was saying, Ben, people were impressed.
I want to see that sometime, Jim.
I'll show you a picture. Let you hear it.
What is the best garden for making love in?
A lush garden, but I think a lush garden where you have just stolen away to have a little cigarette and a martini, and you're in a very lush spot, and you've got some beautiful music. You need speakers. You got to have speakers, and you need a song like what we just heard.
Well, how about this last one? Because we always close out with a guilty pleasure. Well, and, you know, you had so many to choose from.
Well,
right?
I have to give my apologies. Keely Smith, we couldn't get her in. She's one of my all-time favorites still to this day. Still at the Carlisle 2 years ago, sounds just like she did. And there's so many unbelievable, like Edie Gourmet is such an incredible vocalist. She was going to be a guilty pleasure, but I actually think that her her album I Feel So Spanish is so incredible. I'm not going to call it a guilty pleasure, but I think we're going to go with Wayne Newton, whose paths have crossed with mine a few times. And I think this just says all you need to know about Wayne Newton. I love Wayne Newton. He's good for cleaning the house or for any kind of upbeat moment.
You mean his music is? Himself.
I don't think that. No, I met his housekeeper. I don't think that Wayne is cleaning his house.
And this is the way we go out with the song, as you are out with a bang, certainly, and visiting a place that, have you spent any time in this particular place that Wayne sings about?
Yes,
in
I
your
have
gardens?
His home. Well, I have Shangri-La. I mean, his home is called Casa de Shenandoah, but I swear to God, he has penguins and things and birds. And so there's some, you know, so
my
you have,
God.
Here you go.
And you get to see many of the Shangri-Las that Jack DeLashman has chosen in Hampton's Gardens, published by Asselineau.
Correct.
And out and about and, you know, whatever. It's there, it's available.
It
you
is.
Can find out more. Google it. Hampton's Gardens, Jack DeLashman. Thank you so much.
That's great.
For visiting here.
I loved it. It was so much fun. It was difficult, but fun.
Difficult, but fun. So yes. Let's just take it out with Wayne.
Let's take it
let's
out.
Let's go visit.
Let's go visit Wayne Newton.
Your kisses take me to Shangri-La. Each kiss is magic that makes my little world a Shangri-La.
You've been listening to The Song Is You, produced and hosted by Bonnie Grice. The executive producer is Linda Lippman. The engineers include Charles DeMontebello and Ethan Donaldson at CDM Studios in New York City, and Kyle Lynch and Matt Cooper at Peconic Public Broadcasting in Southampton, New York. To learn more and hear some sample shows, check out our website, thesongisyou.org. The Song Is You is a division of BLG Productions. Continuing adventures in public media.